Coffee Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com on DAB, and on our podcast, which is now available on Spotify. I'm AD Packham, and we will be bringing you some obscure shirt or other to your attention, of course, with the aid of oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last Saturday we stank the place out, apparently, so we don't want to talk about that. Instead, myself and Alan Wares are delighted to present you with a bona fide Albion legend. In a playing career that spanned 16 years, 8 clubs and 4 countries, he turned out 109 times for the Albion between 1980 and 1983, scoring 22 times. Upon retiring, he became a football administrator and he was the head of the Scottish FA between 2007 and 2010. However, his name will always be linked to one moment in time. In 1983, that has gone down into football folklore and gave a fanzine its name and spawned a novel. It is often forgotten, though, that Smith did, in fact, score. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to welcome Gordon Smith. Welcome, we finally got you in here. It's taken us a few years of asking. Yeah. But you're back in Brighton for the weekend, and welcome.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it. I'm down. I've had a few meetings with people, seeing friends down here. And I'm going to the game to watch the match, so I think it's great to be down.
It's amazing that, I mean, obviously we always comes down to, like I said in the intro there, that moment in time, but it appears that you might have been forgiven by now.
No, the fans in general have been fantastic over the years, even at times when I've come down and I've spoken at different events, and I've even done half-time team talk, like interviews in the pitch, and I've apologised, and everybody keeps saying, don't apologise anymore, you don't have to. But I do feel it, I do, because I felt at the time, I've never got over it, to be honest with you. It was a bad miss. I should have scored. I made the wrong decision. I decided to hit the ball hard and low, close to his feet. I thought Gary Bailey, the goalkeeper, would come towards me, and he didn't, and he dived. And it caught in his feet. He dived the wrong way, and I normally would have hit the ball, got a bit of height on it as well, and I made an error, and I'll never get over it.
But we'll talk about the cup run a little bit later on as well. And but I mean, it's apt that you started with that, because we're going to go right back to where you were born, which is in a place called Kilwinning.
Kilwinning, yeah.
I worked it out. It would take 6 days and 2 hours to walk from where we are now. Oh, it's 441 miles.
Yeah, right? I always say I was born below the famous mountain cone in Kilimanfry's Gyro, but it was a bit of a rough place. I was brought up in Stevenston, though. That was the next town to Kilwinning. Kilwinning was where the maternity hospital was, where I was born. Mm-hmm. I was a second child in the family. We ended up with 4. I've got 2 brothers and a sister, and from that, you know, even from a little kid, you know, living in Stevenston, we were in a council estate, council house. Quite a poor family. We didn't have a lot of money. My dad always had work, which was good, but I was dedicated just from a very early age. I felt I was going to be a footballer, and
your dad was a player as well, wasn't he?
My dad was a player until only at a lower level, though, until he was in his early 20s, but my grandfather had been a professional.
That's Martha Smith.
Martha Smith, yeah. Yeah. Martha Smith was Kilmarnock, the football club Kilmarnock, won the cup 3 times in their history, and my grandpa, Martha, was the only player to play in 2 of them out of the 3. There's no other player has won the cup twice with Kilmarnock, so he won it, and the second time he won it, he was captain. So he was dead before I was born. So I never ever got to meet him or speak to him or learn anything about him.
Interesting thing, though, both Brighton and Kilmarnock are pretty much famous for playing in stripes, but you played for Kilmarnock and Brighton and never wore stripes.
That's right, yeah, neither team did. But it was stripes before. I liked the strip before I went there, but then Kilmarnock started to wear plain blue, and the same with Brighton.
I'm actually just showing Gordon a picture of himself from 1972 in this Kilmarnock. We'll put this up on the internet for you to see, but right. No, that's not it. This is good planning here. I've got more paper. This is a dossier. Here we go. Can you remember that picture there?
Oh, yes, I do that.
And in this particular picture, Gordon's got beautiful. This works really well on the radio, doesn't
long
it?
Hair and the moustache as well. So, no, it's, I remember that beautiful team. Well, I was in the first team. Yeah. I made the first team at Kilmarnock at 17 years of age.
You made your debut on the 26th of August, 1972.
Was it? Right, okay. Yeah, I was 17 and made my debut. And, you know, the funny thing was, when I got in the team, everybody said, oh, you've been for a little while, then you'd be back out because you're in and out of the team. I had no intention of going back out once I was in. I loved every minute of it. Playing in front of a big crowd was a thrill.
What sort of crowds were you getting back then?
Back then, it depends who you were playing against, but we were getting home crowds were roughly around about 8,000, 9,000. But when you played Rangers or Celtic, you know, you were getting a full stadium sort of thing. So it was fantastic. And as I say, when you went to play away from home against these teams, Rangers and Celtic, you got much bigger crowds. And, and I always laugh at people who say, oh, they were nervous about the playing in the big occasion. The bigger the occasion, I just found it fantastic to play in a big in front of a big crowd.
Well, being a professional in the '70s, like, it certainly wasn't about the money, was it? Like it would be now.
Not at all. No, I was poorly paid. I was a part-time player at Kilmarnock. I was still at school when I made the first team. I was, you know, doing my A levels, and then I was a part-time player right through that period. So the highest wage I ever received from Kilmarnock, but even when I left there at 22 years of age, it was £26 a week.
Well, you did move to Rangers, and was that a bit of a culture shock in footballing terms?
It was a shock to a degree, but I was delighted to go because I'd wanted to move to that level for quite some time, and there was a lot of talk in the newspaper that I was going to be moving on, there was going to be clubs interested, and yet it never happened. The move never happened, and then, believe it or not, when I shook hands with Jock Wallace when he signed me, he shook my hand and he said, "Welcome to the club, Gordon." He says, "That's taken a while." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I've been in for you for the last 4 years.
No way.
Twice a year, he said, "I've bid for you," and they've turned me down. Since I was 18, they were trying to get me. Now, Kilmarnock hadn't told me that at all. Now, credibly, this is about 10 years ago, I've got to tell you this, Eddie. I was at a dinner in Glasgow, and who was the speaker? Tommy Docherty. And during his speech, he suddenly looked down, he said, "I see Gordon Smith there, nice to see Gordon. I tried to sign Gordon as Man United manager." And I just looked at my wife, and I couldn't believe it. I went up afterwards and I said, "That what you said there at the dinner, was that true?" And he went, "You didn't know?" And I went, "No." He says, "I offered a
hundred." So basically, your bosses at Kilmarnock,
they didn't tell me anything.
So, I mean, these are massive moves as well. This isn't just
unbelievable.
Like...
Well, Tommy Docherty said he'd offered 100,000 for me. I was 19, he said. "You offered 100,000. Kilmarnock said, "We accept it, but can Gordon play for us tomorrow in the game and we'll do the deal Monday?" And Tommy said, "Okay, that's fine." He said, "You must have played well, Gordon." I went, "Why?" He said, "We went back on the Monday, they wanted more money." And I said, "Wait a minute, we've agreed a fee. And they tried to get more money for me," and he suddenly put the phone down on them, and now no one told me. Now there I am, like at 50 years of age, learning that I could have been at Man United. So I might have been playing against Brighton in the final, you never know, rather than against Man United.
And we would be having a very different conversation.
Totally different. I wouldn't be on your show. You wouldn't have me.
Oh, we would. But I mean, the fee back then, I mean, you're talking about that United would bid about 100,000.
Yeah.
I mean, the fee was about 130,000, which is still big money in 1977.
Yeah, oh, it was a lot of money, as I say. And I think that it was actually less than that because they got Kilmarnock ended up getting two players in as well for me. So there was two players came in. It was a big fee, but you know, you say, how did I feel about it? I was thrilled. I wanted to play at the highest level and go and play for a club like Rangers.
And again, a massive crowds.
Massive crowds.
They average about 50,000 now. Yeah. Back then, they would have been standing and it would have been a lot more than that.
Yeah, that's absolutely. At times, it was more. Some of the games I played, there was 70,000 at them game, you know. So it's fantastic.
But going from that and coming to the Goldstone would have been...
It was a big difference, big shock, you know, at the time. But the thing about it was that... What I found was the difference. Main thing was the difference was the fact that you play for Rangers, you're expected to win every game. At Brighton, you're not. You know, you're underdogs to a certain degree, and it makes it a lot bit easier at times to play. Because at Rangers, if you had two defeats in a row at Rangers, you were in a crisis, and the fans, your own fans would have got you. But the first season I was there, it was fantastic. I mean, you've probably done your research, and I won the treble. In my first season there,
and your record there was brilliant. I mean, you were a midfielder there. You played 98 times and scored 35 times, but I guess.
Yeah, well, that was league games. These are league statistics.
Yeah, Wikipedia is rubbish for this.
Wikipedia
sort of
only gives leagues. It's the same with Brighton. I played 125 games for Brighton and scored 26 goals. And Rangers, I played 150 games. I think I scored 53 goals. So, it's, in terms of overall, but in the league, I scored a goal every three games, which for a midfield player is pretty good.
So basically, Wikipedia are saying you never scored in a cup final.
Yeah, that's true. No, so, they didn't give him a cup final goal, but they do only. Wikipedia, funnily enough, only does cover league.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you did come to Brighton. There must have been a lot of other clubs into you. I mean, you've already mentioned Man United when you were at Kilmarnock. What made you choose to come down to the South Coast?
Well, I didn't choose, to be honest with you, because the true story about it is that I had no intention of coming to Brighton because John Gregg, the manager of Rangers, asked me to come down and meet Alan Mulally as a favour to him because they were friends. He said, "But I don't want to sell you." And it wasn't until I was down here chatting with Alan Mulally and then found out later on by the coach who'd come down with me that the deal was done. Rangers wanted to sell me, and I agreed to come. But I don't hold any grudge, because I look back on it now, and it was a fantastic period. I'm so glad I came down here. But I had no intention of coming at first when I came down. I was only coming down because the season was finished. I was doing John Gregg, the manager, a favour by coming to meet Alan Murray. But I had an instant liking for Alan Murray. I thought he was great.
Well, I mean, this was summertime as well, and Brighton in the summer is always a wonderful place to come.
Absolutely. Well, I soon found out when I moved down here what a difference in the weather. It was wonderful to come down here and start a different lifestyle altogether. My son was a month old when we came down here. We bought a nice house in Hove and in the Chatfield area at Hove Park.
Yeah.
So I used to be able to home matches. I could walk to the match on a Saturday. It was like a 5-minute walk to the ground. So where else do people play football that you're that close to your football stadium? Very rarely does that ever happen.
Well, there's a lot. I guess around Ibrox, there's a lot of tenements and stuff around there, isn't there?
Correct.
And there would have been player lodgings as well.
There was nobody lived near Ibrox in my time. Then.
Really?
Not at all. No. Funny enough, the strange thing was that's something that I could talk about, because when I was at Rangers, we all lived quite some distance. Some of the boys lived in Glasgow, but other parts of Glasgow nowhere near it. Some were living in Edinburgh. I was still living down in Stevenston, where I was brought up. So we only met in training and match days. There was no socialising basically in the team at all. Whereas when I came to Brighton, the whole team basically lived within about half a mile of each other, because we were all living in Hove, and there was a great social life with the players. We've got so friendly.
There's a lot of managers that actually insist on players living within a certain distance of the ground, though, as well. Yeah. And that, like you said, I mean, it does help with bonding and becoming closer to a closer unit.
That is true. I think there was only a couple of players. I think Jerry Ryan was one of them who lived in Hayward's Heath.
Yeah, Linfield.
Yeah, but the rest of the boys, you know, loads of them, Foz and Mark Lawson and John Gregory, everybody that we were all friendly with, we all lived in Hove. And as I say, it meant there was a big bonding sort of thing. All the wives and girlfriends became friendly too, so there was a lot of socialising there, and it was a lovely place to live. And that's why I'm saying to you that I never regretted it for a minute coming here, despite the fact that when I originally was coming down here,
the sun was shining. If it was raining, it'd be a different story.
A different story.
You'd be back in the car and back up again.
Exactly. It was two things. I changed my lifestyle, lovely place to live, good weather, and a good bunch of people I got involved with down here. I liked the players and the staff and everybody.
Okay. I mean, there's a disparity in how much we paid for you. One source says 400,000, another one says 792.
No, it was actually 440,000. That's how much it was.
So, and that was in 1980. Again.
1980.
So this was again. It sounds like peanuts compared to.
Oh no, that was a lot of money then, and I was a record fee for Rangers. The record sale fee for a player in their history was that sale. 440,000, and it was the second highest equal ever in Scottish football. Steve Archibald had just gone to Tottenham about a month before for more money, and then I equaled Kendall Gleish going to Liverpool at 440. So that was the fee, and as I say, I think they only went above that when they bought in Mick Robinson came in, and he was dearer than me.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when you were
signed
by Alan Mullery, he described you as the Trevor Brooking of Scottish football. Would you say that's a fair description?
I think there was a degree of it. I actually said that, and once an article saying him, I'm maybe more of a Martin Peters than I am a Trevor Brooking.
because he played in the World Cup final. So
yeah, that's true. But I think that I was the type of player. What I was I was a midfielder, but I was an attacking midfielder, and I like to get in the box and create. I like to create goals and score goals rather than being a type of player who's in tackling.
Yeah, I mean, you weren't an out-and-out striker, were you?
I wasn't an out-and-out striker.
And that's a popular myth.
Yes. A lot of people thought I was. I'll tell you why that came about, though, because when I played in the final, the run we had just before the FA Cup final, I had to play up front, because what happened was Peter Ward had gone back to on loan. I think it was
Forest,
and we had brought in Teddy Connor, who was cup tied.
Yeah,
so we were a striker short.
But Andy Ritchie was around as well.
Andy Ritchie was around, but I was put in there, and Jimmy Melia felt I could do a job alongside Mike Robinson, and it did work out, because in that little spell I had scored goals. But I was an attacking midfield player, and what he liked about me, I mean, nowadays we call it the number 10 role.
Yeah.
It's that kind of free role midfield that you go and join in with the front men, right? And that's the role that Alan Mullery thought I could do in that first season, and I was so pleased with that, because he was a great help to me, And it's always great when a manager is on your side and has confidence in you.
And of course, he was a fabulous player as well in his own in his own right as well. So, I mean, did you take anything on board from that, or does it when you're signing for a club as a player and you know the manager as a player, does that inspire you? Does that tempt you to go to that club?
Yeah, it definitely inspired me, the fact that somebody was so he's so positive towards me on the basis, and he'd been a top class player. That is actually good when somebody thinks that way. And I got a great thrill from that, because he did an article one day, and I'd been scoring goals and I went there at first. He says, I actually thought if Gordon can get 10 goals this season, I thought that'd be absolutely fantastic, but he might even get more than that. That's what he said, because he says he's been scoring goals. So I got the hat trick at Coventry. We drew 3
weeks with Coventry. Yeah, got that here, 3-3, yeah, 19-minute hat-trick.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll come to that bit in a minute. But, I mean, one of your first appearances at the Goldstone was actually in a pre-season friendly. And there was a pre-season trip to Holland.
Yes.
And then it was reversed, and those clubs came over here.
Yeah.
One game was a friendly against Sparta Rotterdam. Can you remember any of the players in that team?
No, I don't.
Louis van Gaal played at Goldstone that day, and Danny Blind as well.
Yeah, I couldn't have told you that.
There you go. So you played against those at Goldstone. But when you made your league debut, it was against Wolves on the 16th of August 1980. ABBA's winner takes it all was at number one.
Yes, that's now, right, yeah.
Now, this is back. I normally at this point would tell you exactly who was playing the Brighton centre that weekend, but the programme didn't actually have those stats in there at that particular moment. It was the season after that started, so there you go.
See, I always count that as my debut, because I always think that's a serious game, a proper game. So I actually always say, if anybody asks me, I scored on my debut for Brighton.
Can you remember the team that day?
Our team?
Yeah.
No, not really. I think we probably Mosebin goals.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
John Gregory. Yep. Steve Forster.
Yep.
Mark Lawrence and
yep.
Gary Williams.
Yep.
Neil McNabb. No.
Yes.
Yeah. Brian Horton.
Yes.
Myself.
Yes.
Peter Sutherland.
Yes. Sully wasn't there.
Sully wasn't. So.
Pete Ward.
Peter Ward and Mick Robinson.
And Ray McHale was the other one.
Ray McHale had just been signed. He got signed at the same time as me, and Mick Robinson.
Peter Sayer was on the bench, of course.
Leo's brother, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you must have got some stick about that.
Oh, yeah, Sayer. Definitely, yeah.
Were you trying to get tickets off him as well?
We were trying a little bit, but he wasn't coming across with him, you know. But it was, I remember him well, but the thing is, I say that that was a good team. There was one or two changes came in after that, but I just felt that, you know, it was great to get off to a winning start and get a goal.
And you scored. And you remember who scored the other goal as well?
Was it Mick Robinson, I think?
No, it wasn't.
Was it not?
It was John Gregory.
Oh, was it John?
Yeah. So, and again, another. I mean, looking at that team, you've got quite a few players that actually went on to be managers. It was a decent team. And then, we've got your 19-minute hat-trick in the 3-3 draw at Highfield Road.
That was amazing. We were down 3-0. And I got the hat trick, but to this day I'm a bit disappointed with that one too, because what happened was, in the last minute, I had a header from a corner that beat the goalkeeper and it got cleared off the line, so I could have had 4, and that would have been a bit much better. But I got on the Wednesday night we had a game, and I got the match ball. I got an award given to me by Jimmy Greaves. I was voted player of the month, and Jimmy Greaves came in at the Goldstone and gave me a trophy, and I got the match ball for the match too, so I've still got that somewhere.
Okay, I mean that team did okay that season, but it didn't put up any trees. So the season afterwards, I mean, did you think that it was more than just consolidation, we could have pushed on a bit?
Well, what happened was, that season it was an amazing finish we had, because if you check it out, we were in relegation trouble, and we had a big meeting about it, and we had 4 games to go, and we more or less, at the meeting, we more or less agreed with each other that we need to probably win the 4 games, because it was 2 points for a win in those days, right? And we went out, and Alan Mulley changed the team. We had a big discussion on it. He changed the team back to the way we'd been playing at the beginning of the season, which was actually to put me back in that role again that I'd been playing. He changed the team about, and we won the 4 games. So it was a fantastic finish to the season. 4 great performances, great wins, and Alan Mulley resigned. So that was a real blow.
So that was over the sale of Mark Lawrenson, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, again, Man United come into it again. It seems to be a recurring theme here.
Yeah.
Mulley didn't want to sell him, did he?
No. Stop. But the thing was, I remember speaking to Mark Lawrenson at that time, and he had the chance, believe it or not, to go to 4 teams. it was Man United, Liverpool, Spurs, and Arsenal were all wanting him, and he decided to go to Liverpool, but he could have gone to any of those four teams because he was such a popular player. Mm. And Mothers didn't want that to happen, I don't think. And I was gutted with it. I'll tell you why. Because even somebody signs you, a player, when a manager signs you and then leaves, you know you've got to once again have to deal with a new manager coming in. You don't know whether you're going to fit in with his style of play. And that's exactly what did happen, because Mike Bailey had a different mindset about how we should play.
But I mean, just how good a player was Mark Lawrenson to play alongside him?
Oh, he was excellent. You could tell he was young. He was still young, but he was maturing. But he had a great pace, and he read the game very well. And you knew that he was going to be a star. You know, you knew that sometime he was going to get, teams would like him. And he went and he fitted really well into that Liverpool team. He made the right choice to go there.
Yeah, and he's a legend there as
correct.
Well.
Correct, yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes he still remembers he actually used to play for Brighton.
He does, sometimes.
So Mullers quit over that, and Mike Bailey came in. You didn't necessarily see eye to eye with Mike Bailey. He wanted to play you as an out-and-out striker, didn't he?
No. He played me in the left wing, right. Basically. I became left midfield. And what happened was it was very stringent in terms of the instructions you got. You had to completely do everything. I was a type of player that played with a bit of flair. I could see situations develop and then make runs and go places that I felt I could cash in on. Yeah. Whereas Mike Bailey was more or less dictating to me where I should be at all times. You've got to be here.
So regimented. Basically.
Regimented it was. Now, it worked to an extent, but it didn't suit me. But the funny thing was he signed Mickey Thomas. And Mickey Thomas, he came in that day, he didn't play in the game. And this is true. Mickey Thomas came in after the game and he said to me, "Well done, Gordon, you did really well." And I said, "Yeah, my last game." He went, "What do you mean?" I goes, "That's why he signed you. He's going to play you there." And he goes, "I couldn't play the way you had to play today. I'm not going to play there." He goes, I want a free role in the midfield, centre midfield. I went, "Well, that's why he's bought you." He goes, "I know that's why he's bought me, but I'm not going to play there." Sure enough, team got picked the next game. I was still in. And Mickey Thomas came in and played centre midfield. So he'd actually said to Mike Bailey, "I'm not playing there." And so I thought I was going to be dropped at that point, but I kept in the team. Yeah. But the thing was, my goal scoring ratio went down a lot.
Yeah, you only got to score twice, I think,
yes,
for that season.
Went down, totally down, because I was more or less playing. I was like defensive midfield on the left side. So I wasn't getting in the box, I wasn't doing my job, and it was frustrating for me. That's what I was really frustrated, and we didn't see eye to eye because of that.
Mm. But other players did come in that season as well, who you would have played alongside in the cup final as well, and one was, of course, the late great Tony Grealish
came in. Tony was a great lad, good player too, good signings they were, actually, because Jimmy Case was the
he
other
came
one
in
I imagine.
As well.
Fantastic signings, you know,
and Andy Ritchie at the same time.
Andy Ritchie, that's right. Well, but I have to say that you know, those two players were great signings for us. They were, and they fitted in with the style of play Mike Bailey wanted. They were both kind of defensive midfield players, tacklers and all that. The difference was between the two of them was Jimmy Case had a great shot on him. Jimmy Case could score goals for the distance, and he did. He scored a few cracking goals.
Just.
He was magnificent, but Jimmy was also terrifying for a lot of players as well. There was a great, I remember we played Liverpool that season when Jimmy came in, and I said to one of the Liverpool players afterwards, I said, "Graeme Souness was a bit quiet today. It wasn't his usual heavy marauding self." And he went, "No, why?" And I went, "No," he says, "because you've got Jimmy Case in your team now." He says, "Graeme knows not to mess about with Jimmy Case." So I thought, yeah.
So I mean, how many times would Jimmy get sent off now, and the way he played? Because
he left
it all out there, didn't he?
Oh, he did. Jimmy didn't bother one little bit about it. Certain places sort out. And I used to notice that what happened, Eddie, when somebody had a bad tackle on him, I clocked him right away, looked up to see who it was, and you thought, there's going to be revenge later in this game.
As research for the show today, I watched most of the cup final again, and it's like watching a completely different ball game. It really is. It's like some of the tackles that are going in.
I know.
And the pitch as well.
The pitch was terrible. I mean, that was an amazing thing the chance to play at Wembley, when it also this great reputation has been one of the best pitches in the world. But we happened to play on it, and it's one of its worst days because of the rain. It was heavy, soaking wet. But Jimmy got stuck in, as he always did against Man United. That was a one team as well where he was quite aggressive, as you probably noticed.
Yeah, but another game we need to talk about where you scored as well was you scored at Selhurst Park. You beat against Crystal Palace.
Yeah, that was one of my. It was actually one of my favourite goals. That actually a header, because I made the other two goals that day. John Gregory scored the other two. I made the two goals for him. And that was in that little run I was telling you about earlier.
We had
the four games. The first game we had was at Selhurst Park, and we went there and we played really well. I made the two goals and scored a header as well from a Gary Williams cross, so I was delighted with. It's still on, that one's out on YouTube, you can get that to look at, and I was delighted with that goal.
Oh, that comes out quite a lot.
Yeah.
Can't think what. Were you surprised when Mothers went to Crystal Palace after what happened?
I mean, the
rivalry was kind of fledgling at that particular moment in time.
Yeah.
And it all started with Mothers. So
it's
the
good,
fact
it's a
they
good point.
Went there.
Yeah, it's a good point you're making, because someone, I didn't know this until, because I used to ask him, like, why is this the derby game? Like, you know, I know it's the Eagles versus the Seagulls, right? But I used to ask why, and they said it was because of the rivalry between Mullers and Terry Venables.
That's right, yeah.
That's how the whole thing kicked off. And then what happens was Mullers leaves us and then goes to Crystal Palace.
No one could quite work that one out. But it was a bit of a shocker.
Interesting.
But yeah, but I mean, and geographically, they are the closest team to us as well.
Well, they are to a degree, but people, even in Scotland to this day, when I say that's a derby game, people don't understand that. They always think it should be Portsmouth.
It's everyone's key. When we play them, we get inundated with requests. Can you tell us about the rivalry? Can you tell us about the rivalry? It's like, no, we've done it already.
Yeah.
But okay, but you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I brought you in association with oldfootballshirts.com. And just for a change, we've got two shirts of the week this week. One of which was actually last week's. So we didn't actually know Gordon was coming in then. But those of you would have actually seen this already. But I'm just going to hand this one over to you. I haven't actually got the description, but can you tell me what team that is?
No idea.
I'll give you a clue. You played for them.
I played for them, right? In England?
No.
Then it's FC Basel.
No.
I don't know who that is then. It's in Admiravaka.
There you go.
Is that Admiravaka?
It is Admiravaka.
My
And
goodness.
That was our shirt of the week last week. I just thought we wanted to see
that's
if you
changed.
Would recognise
that's
it.
That's changed totally from what I played in.
That's beautiful. But this is the actual proper one. So if you can just describe that for me.
Yeah.
And see if you can pick up a link from that.
Well, it's obviously a white shirt with a V that comes down from either shoulder. It's very nice, actually, one of the attractive ones.
Yep.
But that's good. That's not Admiravaka, is it, as well?
That's not Admiravaka, no.
But I couldn't have told you that other one.
But you must know what the team that team is.
Is that FC Basel?
No. It is kind of linked to you, but you probably won't get it from... You'll know the team, for sure.
Yeah. Is it a British team?
Yeah.
Scottish?
Yes.
Airdrie, no.
There you go. This is what we've got here. This is Airdrie Onion's shirt, and it was an unsponsored shirt in the same style as a shirt worn by Airdrie Onion's against Kilmarnock on the 28th of October 1972.
Ooh.
Can you guess the significance of that date?
Was I playing that day then?
You were playing. It was when you scored your first ever goal for Kilmarnock.
Oh, right,
there
yeah.
There you go.
And so it was against Airdrie, I couldn't have told
Airdrie,
you that.
And they were wearing... Not that shirt, but a version of that.
My first goal was against Deirdre. I couldn't have told you that.
And but the shirts were pretty. Your shirts were. You wanted a Kilmarnock one, but they were pretty.
I know. Stripes.
Edria nicknamed the diamonds from the distinctive design of the shirt, which extends onto the back of the shirt, and they are always referred to as the diamond and never a V. The original Edrionians went bankrupt in 2002, and they won the Scottish League Cup in the previous two seasons, but ended up resigning from the league with a £3 million debt, which they couldn't pay. The last ever home match had to be abandoned when fans invaded the pitch and broke the crossbars. There you go. But Alan, welcome back
into
the room.
Hello.
And you've joined us for 1983 and all that.
Who knew? Who knew? Was there anything particularly significant about 83 that we've got this chap in? any particular reason? Because it's one of those things that's kind of forgotten in the midst of time as to what happened. So I'd be really grateful, Wade, if you could actually sort of let us know.
Well, the season started. Well, the season started, and Mike Bailey was still in charge. Now, we were talking about Mike Bailey and how regimented he was, and the board weren't very happy with the style, and eventually he did get the boot because of that. But he did actually give us the highest ever league placing.
He did, because we were very hard to beat, and that was because of the way we set up, and that's why there was a disagreement about the style. I was one of the people who didn't agree with it as well, But I have to give him credit for one thing. He got us playing a defensive way that made us hard to beat, as I say. And he used to say before games, I mean, he actually came out and said it, and this is one of the arguments I had with him. He said, 0-0 will do me today. That's what he said before the game. And I'm thinking, you know, surely we should be thinking more about being positive.
That sends out the wrong signal completely.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what he said, 0-0 will do me. So I had one or two arguments with him about that. And then
does that mean he didn't really sort of support the forwards then in and actually trying to get sort of the what he wanted done? I mean, obviously, you know, if the other team has got whatever it is nil, then fine, you're going to pick up points. But does that kind of imply to you that, well, sit deep and sort of see what if Gordon and Michael can do something?
That's exactly what happened. What was I was playing left side of midfield for him, and I was saying to Eddie that I was playing a sort of defensive midfield, that my role was basically to just stop, because what he did was he had us playing in such a way that teams weren't allowed to go down the wide area against us. We had to force, I had to go and be more wide to force the fullback even or whatever inside all the time. And it worked pretty well, because what he said was that Steve Foster and Steve Gatting were better if they could remain centrally than getting dragged into wide positions. So we made every team play down the middle, and it worked to a degree in that respect. But it also meant that because I was an attacking player, a creative player, I thought in my own mind, I wanted to be more getting forward, but he stopped that. He said, no, I don't want you there, I want you making sure you're... So that was what he did. That's why he was settling for 0-0, because he was more or less saying, you know, we'll stop teams playing and scoring goals against us, and if we don't score, that's okay, I'll settle for 0-0. And I just didn't agree with that.
And the crowd were getting restless as well.
They were a bit. Yeah,
especially at the time. I think it was probably the first, that might have been the first season that 3 points or a win was introduced.
Was it? Yeah.
So it was either the first or second season. Yes. So that would have completely undone his philosophy, because a draw in those days, you know, was worth a lot less compared to 2 points for a win.
But, I mean, was that why you went back to Rangers on loan?
No, what happened, it was quite a strange one. I was out of the team. I'd been out of the team for a few weeks. I had an argument with him, and he left me out. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call from Rangers, and it was Tommy McLean, the assistant manager, who had been an ex-teammate of mine. He said, we'd like you to come up on loan, Gordon, for a month. And I was like, okay. I said, I'll think about it. I'll go and speak to Jimmy Melia, the chief scout, and ask his advice. So I went to see Jimmy Mealy, and I said, look, Jimmy, I says, I've got a chance to go back to Rangers on loan. I want to ask you, what do you think I should do? I'm out of favour. He says, you can go back, Gordon. He says, you'll get to play in a cup final, won't you? And I went, Jimmy, I've played in 6 cup finals. It's not as if I don't know if I need to play in a cup final. And he went, yeah. And he goes, no, he says, playing it. He says, you'll be with your family over Christmas and New Year. And then he hit me with a tremendous bit of information that no one else had. You know what he said? When you come back in a month's time, I'll be manager.
So he knew then?
He told me then.
Wow.
That he'd be manager. Now, he said, don't tell MD this, but when you come back in a month's time, I'll be manager.
So the writing was already on the wall for Mike Bailey.
Yes. And right. he said, you'll get back in the team under me. That's what he said. So I had to go, and I couldn't tell any of the other players Mike Bailey's getting the boot. But Jimmy Melia told me that.
So you had a little bit of an internal party then?
A little bit of a boogie.
I was pleased, because I thought, all right, I'll go up to Scotland and play. And I'll come back down, and Jimmy, and he was straight enough. We came back down, and he was in charge.
Okay, we'll carry on with that in a minute, but first, I've got a little bit of a quiz for you.
All right.
Which is something we like to do. Now, I need your answers, and these are answers from 1983.
Okay.
Okay. So this is your player profile from the program.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
as written by whom?
Yeah, exactly.
So, basically, apparently you were married.
I was.
And you had two brothers and one sister, and your car at the time would have been a...
Car at when I was playing for Brighton was a BMW.
Yes, it was. Favourite player?
Favourite player, Pelle?
No.
At that time?
Yeah.
Maradona?
No,
not that early.
No, he was too. He wasn't.
We're moving on.
Jim Baxter.
Jim Baxter. He was Mario Kempes and Franz Beckenbauer.
Oh, yeah. Well,
which we'll talk about shortly.
Yeah.
Your favourite team other than Brighton? You said?
Rangers.
Norway.
No way.
I think it was actually, you probably said no way, but someone actually mistook it as Norway.
No way. Yeah. Says no way.
Most memorable game at that point, we hadn't played in the cup final at that point.
Against Juventus in the European Cup, yeah.
Favourite ground you said was the Goldstone. Mm-hmm. Hobbies you said, too personal to mention.
Is that what I said? Playing guitar.
Your ambitions were to win a trophy with Brighton.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was that year. Oh my goodness!
Yeah. Well done.
I nearly did.
We're back to where you were born again.
Born again, yeah.
Okay, your favourite food?
Beef Stroganoff?
Yes, it was.
There you go.
Still is.
Favourite music?
Beatles.
No.
Paul McCartney.
Paul McCartney was there, yeah.
Yeah.
And Squeeze and Billy Joel.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Squeeze big at that time, yeah. I was a big Squeeze fan.
Al, you're surprised by that, because the normal one would have been...
Mine?
No, it was normally Dire Straits.
It's always Dire Straits and Phil Collins. All the white players had one, and all the black players like Luther Vandross and Diana Ross. Yeah.
Your best TV programme at the time?
1983. No idea.
Minder?
No, it was not the 9 o'clock news.
All right.
Person most admired outside football was...
Person outside of football, person most admired?
Outside.
A politician, was it?
No.
No? A musician?
No.
No?
I'll give you a clue.
Who was it?
The Spanish Des Lynam.
Spanish Des Lynam?
Yeah.
No idea.
Michael Robinson.
Really?
That's what you said.
Spanish Des Lynam.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the thing is, he does all the commentary over in
England. He does,
presenting, yeah.
And we'll finish with biggest disappointment in life.
Biggest disappointment in life?
Up to 1982.
Up to 1982. Well, the cup final was my bigger disappointment.
You said playing cards with Fozzie for money.
Yeah.
Okay, well, moving on. So basically, Jimmy Media came in, and it was with George Aitken as well. Yeah. We got relegated that season, so yeah. I mean, it wasn't. There was too much emphasis on the cup run, do you think?
You know the strange thing? Most people hardly even noticed we were relegated because of the cup run. That's the truth. And you know the strange thing about it? And I always use, when I'm doing media stuff now, I actually refer to this a few times. I'll say, do you know what relegation form is? When you're playing well and you're not getting results. Because we were unlucky in so many occasions in that run. We really were.
We never got thrashed away.
There's games. There was a classic one. I did some stuff for the programme recently, and it was a game against Everton that I scored a penalty that day. Then Everton equalised with about 2 minutes to go. I scored the goal, and it was disallowed for a foul, which I've since watched, and there was no way it was a foul. So rather than getting a 2-1 win, I thought we're getting a 1-1 draw. Everton scored in about the 91st minute.
Right.
To win the game, and that was the difference of what was happening. We were unlucky in so many occasions, but you know what? We got a little bit of the breaks came for us in the cup run.
Absolutely,
it was quite strange.
Got home ties, and we got
you played in the 4-0 victory over Man City. I think it was one of your first.
That was my first
back.
Game back because the month while I was away in Scotland, they played in the cup final up there, and when I came back after that month, the Newcastle game had already been played, so we already had got through. And that was, we drew Man City, and then I scored that game.
I have a tiny scar across the bridge of my nose, which I actually picked up that day. Very, very quickly, what it was the players were doing a warm-up, and I was in the north stand with my head sort of resting back against the fence that they had in those days. And you know what you do? You turn around, you put your nose up against the fence.
Yeah.
And with that, a ball went smack straight into my face, but it was obviously the fence, and the fence metal into my nose. So I got taken to first aid, and I actually missed the first goal scored by Jimmy Case.
Do you know who it was that kicked the ball, hit you in the face?
No, I didn't even see it coming.
It was Jimmy Case. It wasn't you.
I didn't even see the ball coming. The first thing I knew was just this bang.
We put in a really good performance that day.
We did. It was, yeah. And again, on a pitch that was like the moon.
Yeah.
Let's just fast forward then to the semi-final against Sheffield Wednesday. Obviously, neutral ground. Baking hot day at Highbury.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those magical days.
It's a memorable day. Mm. It was a fantastic performance. I got the man of the match that day too, which was great because I could have scored the winner that day, but Mick Robinson got in my way, and I was actually having a go at him.
So basically,
for getting us to Wembley.
So basically, this was him passing to you in the final. Then was like
that was his revenge.
That's why he did it.
Because what happened was I played a couple of 1-2s with Jimmy Case. I shot and the goalkeeper saved it, and I picked up the rebound and they went past him, and I'm about to play it my left foot, and Mick Robinson came across me, more or less took it off me, and I'm about to go at him. And he's fired in the net, so where do you go? You went, well done, Mick. I'm happy with that. Because, to be honest with you, what a thrill it was to get to the final. The whole place, just went into raptures. It really did. The whole of Brighton was
taken. Well, we had the clock end and we made a noise, didn't we?
Yeah.
We had the open clock end. And I mean, Jimmy Cowes scored the screamer from, well, frankly, from the North Bank.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those goals against. It's like Gary Nelson's goal against Brentford. It's more and more people. It gets further and further.
Further away.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it was some strike. But Jimmy had a habit of doing that. And I've got to say, if I had to choose one player from the cup run that stood out right through the cup run, Jimmy Case.
He was
outstanding.
He was probably each and every game he had a major role.
Definitely.
You know, he scored the winner against Liverpool. Scored the winner against Liverpool. He scored the
winner against Norwich.
Norwich.
And he scored against Man City.
He was the man of the cup.
I think he was too.
But I mean, back then the FA Cup was something special. It really was the magic of the cup, which is sadly lacking now.
I think you're right. I think that's what's taken away. The cup was fantastic in those days, shown all around the world. It was the biggest club match in world football. Every country was taking it, and it's such a shame.
It was really the only match that was ever shown live on television. Even the England internationals, you only had one highlight from Sportsnet.
Correct, that's exactly right. And
the Scotland ones as well, now and again.
Yeah, now and again. But no, it was, you're right, absolutely. Everybody around the world saw that game. And as I say, it was a thrill to play in it. I mean, the build-up was fantastic as well, because we'd done the song, recorded the song.
Well, I was going to ask you
about singing it.
I was going to ask you about that, because I mean, apparently you are a bit of a crooner. There's a song which the only thing I can remember Boys in the Old Bright and Blue, and I can remember the Goldstone rap. But apparently there's a song called Seagulls Are Flying.
Where Seagulls Fly by Johnny Wakelin, who'd had a hit in the early 70s with a song called In Zaire. You asked me to dig it out this week. I cannot play it on the show because it is, you know, I like my cheesy music.
Yeah.
This is cheese that's actually so bad it's actually jumped off the table and run away to the bin.
He was singing.
This is the one I'm singing on.
No, it's just Johnny Wakelin. If there was another one, I don't know.
There's a song called Seagulls Are Flying, which was, I think it might have been on the 12-inch version of it or something, but it was, you sang on it, didn't you?
Well, somebody couldn't remember, they chose somebody, if we won the cup, they said, we've got the Golson rap out. If we win the cup, we're going to bring out another song. So they tested us all, and they came up with the people who did the recording decided I was the person to do the solo.
Right.
So my miss didn't spoil my football career, but it spoiled my music career because the song never came out.
So, right, that's why we can't find it.
Oh, I wish you could find that, because I've never heard that since.
Okay, Anorak's out there, find us
please
the song.
Please find that song.
And we will send it.
Remind us, what's the song called?
Seagulls Are Flying.
And is it actually listed as by Gordon Smith?
Well, no, it's not by Gordon Smith.
I sang it, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an Albion choir.
It was probably the Albion, but it was, I don't know whether I get singly listed for it, but I actually...
Can you remember it now? Can you give us a pass now?
I cannot remember one bit of it.
One of the big things about cup finals is going and getting measured up for the suits. Now, I understand that you are very good at procuring suits for people.
Yes.
Now, what can you tell us about that?
Well, I just said I had a good contact for getting suits and doing things for players and getting them, but I didn't have anything to do with the cup final. This was Jimmy Melia's idea, and we couldn't believe it.
These suits that you got, because I mean, nobody seems to know where you got them from.
I got them in Glasgow. There was a wholesale place that I could get the cheap suits for the guys in Glasgow, right?
Is that a euphemism? A wholesale place in Glasgow.
Yeah, wholesale place. So I got them. I was already getting good deals for years. The place is still in the go up there, actually.
Right.
You know, it's still there. But I used to get the suits, and I get the deals for the players. And then all of a sudden, Jimmy Melia said, I've chosen gear, we have to get measured up, I've chosen the outfits, and we couldn't believe it when we turned up and we got the suits given to us. Well, it was a jacket, it was a beige jacket, dark black trousers and beige shoes.
Yep.
Right, remember?
Yep, not like licorice also.
None of us, and it's the only time, I always remember this, that a few of the clubs I was at, we got gear to wear, and I could wear it on other occasions. I don't think there's one of us ever wore that stuff again.
Not even at the do afterwards at the Brighton Centre later, did you?
No.
We
all get off it. As soon as it was finished, that was it. Because
absolutely,
it just wasn't that clever. And you know, the thing about it was, this is the funny part of it, we turned up for the pre-match meal and we came downstairs in the hotel and Jimmy didn't have his on. And we're like, where's your outfit? And he said, oh, this is my lucky suit I've got on. I've worn this all the way through the cup run. And one of the boys said, well, don't think we've all got a lucky suit, Jimmy. Right? And Jimmy Case, this is true, Jimmy Case left the hotel and went down to a shop near the hotel and bought a suit and didn't wear the club outfit.
Right.
Yeah, he went out and bought his own suit.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of the build,
ragtag rabble we were.
Yeah.
A lot of the build-up before the game was about the loss of Steve Foster not being able to play in the final. And then, obviously, Tony Grealish came out wearing the headband and stuff.
That's
but,
right.
But before that, I mean, did it matter? Did it affect you going
big,
into it?
Yeah, big effect, losing Foz. I thought it was ridiculous. And fun enough, you know, I know you might want to talk about it later when I was at the SFA. I tried to bring in a rule with the SFA, and I couldn't make any changes. I had to always recommend things, but one of the things I tried to do was that someone shouldn't miss a final because they've been booked in a semi-final. I think it's ridiculous, because you know why? You can't appeal a booking.
No.
So your booking could be totally wrong, and it prohibits you from playing in the final, and I think that's ridiculous. And I tried to change that, and it got voted out.
Well, there was one ridiculous. It was the point. He got booked. I think it was either in the semi final or in the league game. And then he was trying his hardest. I think it was at Notts County, trying his hardest to get sent off. You know, chopping players down, deliberately handballing, and the referee wasn't having any of it. And you think, hang on, you know full well that you know. Even all right, nowadays all you have to do is just sort of blow off near someone, and you could actually get a red card for it. But in those days, I mean, it was sort of like you could take an axe onto the pitch, and still maybe not get
no,
a yellow card.
Correct,
but. You know, Fozzie was doing his best to get sent off because of the perverse thing that a booking would have meant an immediate suspension and a sent off or vice versa. But
no, what I thought Alan, it was a big shame was the fact that this was a club who had never been past quarterfinals before. So this was a historic moment for somebody, and as a captain of the team, to be in a final and not be able to play because of a booking in a semi-final, I just thought.
And he's grown a beard, especially, and everything.
Exactly, out of order, and it was a shame because Tony Grealish was brilliant. He was captain on the day, but we also and Gary Stevens, to be fair, had a fantastic match.
Stormer
in the cup final, right? But Chris Ramsey, I think, might not have played if Fozzie had been fit. I think Gary Stevens would probably have been right back.
Mm-hmm. And yet, I think probably one of the things that we know about this is that, you know, but for the fact that Whiteside was kicking Ramsey up in the air with no protection from the referee, and I think but for the fact if Ramsey had been able to keep up with Whiteside, basically he was almost like a hobbling man, he was almost a dead man walking.
When the goal gets scored.
Whiteside wouldn't have been anywhere near
correct.
It. And, you know, all right, we wouldn't have necessarily won, but things might have been different.
Yeah,
but
absolutely
that was the only
right.
way Whiteside could get out of Ramsey's pocket was
well,
to kick his way
see
out.
You watch it again, and currently it was a red card. It was a straight red card, and Chris Ramsey should maybe even have gone off at that point, because what happened was he limped on, as most players did in those days. They always give you
a
little while.
One substitute as well. So.
Correct. They give you a little while to try and recover, Eddie, right? And what happened was he tried to recover, and while he was trying to do that, Man United scored.
Yeah.
Stapleton equalised. Oh no, I think it was the second goal. Put them in front.
Well,
of
the second goal was the Ray Wilkins one.
The second goal was the Wilkins one. Yeah, well, that was equaliser then. But and he should have been. Whiteside should have been off. They should have been down to 10 men.
Yep.
And Chris Ramsey maybe should have been substituted beforehand. But that cost us. And it's one of, when I saw it again, I thought it was absolutely terrible.
Absolutely. But at least, actually, Gordon, you gave Fozzie the opportunity to play Wembley after all.
I did, yeah. I gave him a chance. I always remember saying that. Thank me for
we
that.
We are going to move on in a second from this. But
are you just going to torture him a little bit more?
Yeah, just a little bit more. Yeah. How many times in your mind have you actually scored that goal?
A lot of times. I've thought about it a lot. And it was this decision-making process, and I made the wrong decision. It's something that very rarely I ever did, because what I normally did always, every time in those situations, was to put my body in a shape that I looked as if I was going to side foot it to the left of the goalkeeper and then fire it the other way. Uh-huh. And what happened in that occasion, for some reason I thought Gary Bailey's going to come towards me, I'll fire it hard and low close to his feet and he won't be able to get down, it'll be in the net, and he didn't come towards me, he just died for some reason, and I regret it
almost.
Yes, I regret it greatly to this day. Bad decision.
Yeah, forgive him. Well, let's put it this way. But for the fact that you scored in, you know, earlier on in the game, we went to
and
extra time.
And what a ball from Tony Grealish that was as well.
I think
it was Gary Howlett.
Howlett
played it in. Yeah.
I mean, Howlett was only sort of 12 years old himself at the
time. He was only a kid. Yeah. That's. I see. To be fair, it probably. No disrespect to Gary Howlett, but it'd probably been better if we'd had another striker that I could have then played the midfield role, which I'm happy, comfortable with. But I played up front that day. I said I scored a goal. I was happy with my goal that day, you know, but...
Let's ask the same question that AD just asked you about the miss at the end there. How many times in your mind have you actually replayed the first, you know, the goal that you did score?
Very rarely, because it just seems to be that happened. I've not replayed that at all. it's the miss that more concerns me. And you know, and I think I scored the goal, I was delighted to do it. I remember walking off at half time, looking up at the scoreboard, that was Man United 0, Brighton 1, and my name was on the scoreboard at Wembley, and I'm thinking, I'm going to be remembered for this now, and I certainly am, you know. But as I say, it's one of those things that, it was quite funny, recently the game in TV was the game against Crystal Palace in the Cup,
yeah.
And I said to my wife, we sat down to watch commentary, I said, well, let's check and see how long it is before they mention my miss in 1983, right? And it was 4 minutes 22 seconds. So that that more or less summed up how important and how crucial.
I mean, nowadays, you've probably got a pizza advert or something.
Like that, but, it was the timing of it, wasn't it? That was the thing.
It was the last kick.
I mean, as soon as I walked away with Gary Bailey at the Bonnie's hands, and I walked away thinking, I could have scored there. That's
have you seen him since?
The final whistle went. No, I've spoken. I did an interview once. He's in South Africa now.
Yeah.
And he was saying on the interview, funnily enough, this was a few years back, he said, I can't believe I don't get credit. He says, all they talk about is Gordon Smith's miss. I went, okay. Gary, I would wish you were getting more credit. You know?
Right, well, let's move it on, because we're running out of time, especially. Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB and on our podcast. I'm here with Gordon Smith, and Alan Wears is with us now.
Finally turned up.
Finally, yeah. After you left the Albion, you had a very good record with Man City. But we'll move on to you became an agent, but you just talked about that on another radio show this week. You didn't like it, so we won't do that.
I found it difficult, but I didn't like the having the deadlines now. You know, the transfer times and all that sort of thing. You know, I think that's wrong. I think you should be able to bring in players at any time of the season, rather than having to do it all in 1 month or whatever.
Do you think then, because of the window, that's why the transfer fees have been ramped up so much, because of the pressure?
Yes, definitely because of it, because there's only a short time to do it. You'll find, it's pretty sluggish at the moment, but you know what, things will be happening the last day. It used to annoy the hell out of me. I sometimes had players in their car driving to a stadium in England, and I'm on the phone negotiating, and if I couldn't negotiate, the player had to turn his car around at 11 o'clock at night and come home, right? It's a joke. So I think that it's a terrible thing to have the transfer window, and I just think they should
do it. Why is it there?
I don't know why it is. I don't know what they're just trying to...
I think it was because, we didn't have it, but the rest of Europe had it.
Yeah.
And we did it to come in.
We did have a transfer window in the respect that it was in March. The player had to be transferred by March, because then what they didn't want was players coming in
just
in order to help teams
win
leagues, cups, or avoid relegation.
Yeah.
So they did have a transfer deadline then.
Yeah, it was a deadline rather than a window.
Window, exactly.
Yeah.
But you did eventually become a football administrator.
Yeah.
Now, that's not something that many footballers actually even think about going into after they hang up their boots.
Well, why did you want to do that then? I mean,
Basically, they approached me, and I hadn't applied. I met the president one day. I was going to Hamden. I think I was doing some work in the media, which I was...
We're talking about the SFA here.
Yeah, I was heavily involved in the media, and the president of the SFA said, hi, Gordon. He says, I've got to ask you something. He says, have you applied for the job here? And I said, no. He says, why not? I said, I'm not interested in it. He goes, there's people, your name's come up, and people would like you to apply. I said,
How come they ask you? Then?
I don't know. I don't know why it was, but I just said, okay. I said, I'll think about it. So he got in touch with me, and it was a recruitment company, then phoned me up and said, the president wants you to come in for an interview. I said, when is it? He said, it's at Hamden on Friday. We've got 6 interviews, and you're number 7. I said, I'm not doing it. And he went, why not? I said, if I come to Hamden on Friday, they'll know that I'm applying for this job and I'm a candidate. I'm not wanting that. So they went, okay. Phoned me up about an hour later and said, right, you come to our offices on Monday, and we'll do your interview on your own with the SFA. I went along, I spoke openly. You know why it was so easy? Because I wasn't wanting the job. So I just said what they should be doing, what's wrong.
Home truths.
Yeah, I gave home truths, what changed this. Next thing I get the phone call, we say, it's yours, you've got it.
Of which you would then say,
I then went, oh, really? You okay? Now, what happened was, the biggest problem I had with that, guys, was I didn't do my due diligence on it in respect of what powers have you got. Now, I went in there and took the job. Chief exec, you think, right, okay. First thing, I'm in there, I'm in with the president and all that. I said, right. I said, there's a lot of faults in this, the SFA, what we're doing. I'm going to change this and this and this. No, you can't. I went, what do you mean? You can't do that. I said, what do you mean I can't do it? They said, well, that goes to this committee. The board do this. I said, what can I actually do? They say, well, you're on these committees and on your own board, but you can make recommendations. That's all you can do. So that was very frustrating.
Mm. So basically, you're powerless.
Yes. But, powerless, but I could make recommendations, and I tried to change quite a few things.
Because, I mean,
I got some things. I got some things changed.
Did you ever hold the kind of the trump card to say, look, you know, the committee's sort of prevaricating on this, and you say, look, hang on,
no,
El Presidente's here, I'm saying this.
No, never. Everything was. It went to a vote. Everything.
Right.
And even when we were selecting a manager, I was annoyed by the fact that we've got a committee of four or five people that were on it. I said, let me choose the new manager. If I'm wrong, I'll be held accountable. And you can get rid of me on the basis I've made a mistake. No, no, it's not your decision and all that. You can make recommendations. So I did a lot of work speaking to people, finding out who was interested in the job, all that kind of thing.
I mean, the thing is, I mean, from our point of view here in Brighton, now, obviously, we don't get to see an awful lot of stuff that goes on in Scotland. But what we did see was you in the press quite a lot and coming up with all these amazing ideas.
Very popular ideas amongst the fans, but it doesn't necessarily follow they're going to be popular amongst football administrators.
But one of these was you were the first person to try and bring in retrospective action for diving.
Yeah, I got it brought in, and they did agree to it in the end.
You have to twist arms?
Yeah, I twist arms, but I had to try and put it across. And the argument was now one of the arguments was they said there's too much. The big clubs are more on TV than others, therefore the major players are going to have a harder time with this retrospective punishment. And I said, well, if they're more on TV than other people, then they deserve to act better and behave better, so that they should be judged on that. And I got it brought in. So we were the first country in the world to bring in retrospective punishment.
But, I mean, the top two didn't like it, did they? They absolutely hated it.
No, they didn't. They didn't like it at all. But
also,
didn't you
actually suffer FIFA's ire as well? Didn't they turn around on you?
FIFA weren't too bad. We had to follow it. They were okay about it. But what happened was we got it in there, and as I say, there was one or two people were saying, and I felt at times we did not put it in properly. We brought in an officer in order to make the decisions, but at times they weren't. And one of the times they said I was actually at the game, and I had actually brought this, and some of the officials had a go at me. They said that I was the one that brought it up. It was no one else. It wasn't the referee, but it wasn't me. It was it was an official from one of the clubs had written and sent in the video.
Yeah.
So this is what you're up against in Scottish football, or football in general. It's probably not just in Scotland.
Is there anything sort of like the way that Scottish football is run that compared to the way that English football is run? Obviously, the way the Scottish is a smaller sort of universe in that sense. But have you noticed that the way that the FA operates compared to the way SFA operates, that actually the pair of them probably needed their heads banging together?
It wasn't much of a difference because I did speak to the chief exec of the FA when I was in charge, and I did it, and they said it was. I spoke about my problems in terms of how to change things and make operations. He said it's the same here. More or less said it was the same. So even with FIFA, I mean, I was in FIFA committees. I was in the football committee of FIFA and UEFA.
I mean, your best mates were Pele.
Yeah, Pele was a friend. He was there. Now,
name dropping.
I'll give you an idea. I am name dropping now, but I'll give you an indication. We had a vote on what should be considered an on-goal. That was they wanted it defined, an on-goal.
Right.
We were having a big discussion on it, and I actually defined what I felt an on-goal should be, and Pele spoke up and seconded me, and that is still the rule to this day.
I always wonder what went on with these committees. I just thought they sat down and talked about what items should be on a fry-up.
So Pele agreed with me, and you know what it is?
It's down to you, the fact that Lewis Dunk is actually one of our top scorers for everyone else. Yeah.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because what I said was, and Pele agreed with this, I said, and he seconded it. It was fantastic for him to do that for me. What I said was, if the original effort from the player is on target but deflects, that player gets the credit. If the original effort is not on target and deflects in, that's an on goal.
And that goes for the same with goalkeepers as well.
If it hits the post, hits the goalkeeper and goes in, it's an on goal.
Yeah.
But what about if
that was my decision?
But what about if it's a shot comes in from someone, it hits one of his colleagues, and goes in? Is it the same for the credit of that as well? Shot that's off target is
if it hits one of his own colleagues, it's the colleague that gets the credit.
Right. Okay,
yeah.
Got you.
But I defined that, and
the thing is, you look at it now, it's actually a fairly straightforward way of looking at it.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. And as I say, it was fantastic. Pele seconded it, and it got put through. That is still, and to this day, you'll hear them saying on the TV, "This is what the rule is." And
the Smith rule.
Yeah. I don't get credit for that.
I mean, you once said to us, you're going to all these meetings. I'm the only person in the room I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't half. I mean, the football committee of FIFA sat down my first meeting and sat beside me. It was Franz Beckenbauer, Pele, Eusebio, Bobby Charlton, Michel Platini, Dragan Stojkovic, and Dino Zoff.
That was the ones at my table. I remember the 83 Cup.
I was the only one I didn't recognise. You're absolutely right.
But the thing is, if you're operating in a committee, does that? I mean, was it ever a hint? Well, you pointed out being a hindrance. I mean, was it ever a help? I mean, do you realise that actually, is there any validity and power in a committee system?
There is if they can make decisions, but the thing about it is I feel at times that the committees were tough. Certainly, the football committee of FIFA and UEFA were okay. It was all ex-players, so we had a kind of communication. I think a lot of things that we could agree on because of that fact we'd all played the game. But when you go to other committee meetings and you get people who have never played the game and have come maybe from another background and they're into football, they see things totally differently and they don't see the way you do.
Right.
But it's making changes.
Does that create a problem?
It does, because you know why? People are so difficult to change. I mean, I tried to change other things like the season, change the season in Scotland and shut down during January, February.
Well, they've
got
a winter break now, haven't they?
Yeah, they've got a winter break now. 3 weeks it is, 2 weeks. They're all playing again this weekend. But the thing about it was I tried to make the winter break longer and play and even the summer months, play in June and all that, and have a shorter break in the summer. And no, I don't want that.
It's Scotland, that makes so much sense because of the weather.
Exactly. You know, the kind word for them, I used to call them traditionalists. That was my kind way of putting it, right?
Yes.
I could give you a few other names that I would call them. You know?
Yeah, you'll get Reverb shut down. No, yeah. So yeah, you kind of find it. It's not so much the committee system per se. It's those who believe. It's almost like they're born to power, and therefore, I mean, it's like probably all those way back in the day when the FA was set up by Lord so and so.
Yes.
And even in Scotland, where it was Lord, you know, somewhere in the Highlands, and Lord somewhere in you know, on the borders, and Lord so and so of the Islands, and you've got these, you know, sort of if not toffs or landed gentry, at least nobility sort of running a game that actually everyone else is.
I know.
And it's still like this, isn't
it? Well, do you know what? I went to Alan. One of my arguments was, I said, right, let's set this thing, guys. Let's say we don't play in January and February at the moment, and the season is how I like to have it. Now, put up a good argument for me if I came along and said, I think we should play in January and February.
Mm.
What would you be saying
to
me then?
Yeah.
You'd be telling me to get lost, what an idiot I was, don't be stupid. You know, that's what you'd be telling me. And yet, when I'm putting it the other way around,
you'd be
no.
To Inverness at Christmas, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, we don't want change. We don't want change in the game.
Now, obviously, the likes of UEFA and FIFA, they've got their problems.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's been there's a whole investigation going in terms of
They're not looking at you, are they?
Rightly so. No, I didn't get any money. I wish I had.
But in terms of the corruption and stuff that goes on there, I mean, did you, when you go into, was it evident? Could you see it going on?
No, I had a feeling. I'll tell you why I had a feeling about it, because you then find out there was committees, certain committees were making the major decisions regarding things like where the next competition should be, World Cup and all that.
Mm.
And then when you actually hear what the decision is, you can't believe it. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, you would have been involved in these discussions.
No, not in these at all. No, that's FIFA committees. That's there's match committees and tournament committees and all that. All we were doing was looking at things in the game, maybe like changes to do with the football side of things. You know, the match things on the pitch. Well, we weren't involved in these kind of things. But you began to get an indication, and you just thought it's not 100%. But who's going to investigate all this? Who can actually pull them up? Because you've got people that blatter at the very top. A committee below them, you didn't know what they were up to.
Mm.
Nobody, there was no real...
Did he?
I think there's no doubt about it. I think he knew exactly what was going on. Do you know what I mean?
He must have. It's the same with Platini, though, because, I mean, he's been held up for problems as well.
Yeah, well, that's... I got on pretty well with him. I found Platini good, but... And he wanted to make changes. He was at least somebody who had ideas to try and change things, but I think... In the end, what happened, him and Blatter didn't really get on that well.
Mm.
You could tell they didn't. And what happened was, I think when Blatter was in trouble, he put Platini in it. I think that's what happened. I think it was him that dropped Platini into it.
Platini, again, like yourself, he's someone who's right at the top of the game, who's gone into administration. As a player, I mean, surely it's better.
Golden fella of his generation, wasn't he?
It's better for a player, someone who's actually played the game, to actually decide the future of the game.
Well, I think you've got an understanding at that point. You're absolutely right, and I think you want to see the game go forward, and you want to see the game take on in the right manner. I mean, I think there's a lot of changes I would have made in Scotland, even in terms of youth development and all that sort of thing. I think that, you know, it's such a shame. There's so many kids in youth football get thrown out the door and their lives get destroyed. You know, they think they've got a career in the way, and all of a sudden, you know, we've found that we've got a situation in Scotland, we've got what's called the development teams at every club, and there's 20 players in the development squad, and we did the research not that long ago and found out there are over 90% every year get rejected by their club. Now, that's ridiculous, really. All these kids are destroyed by this, and some of them fight back.
So they're not actually sort of put in as kind of a support network, that if they working on the assumption that they are going to get rejected, because I mean it's the same, you know, it's the same at the Albion, you know, for all the number of kids they've got going through the development system, the vast majority of them won't make it, but at least they have an education system in place at the same time. Are you saying they don't do that in Scotland?
Not enough. They don't do it enough. A lot of the kids are just left out, but they do have some sort of education there, but a lot of it they're not really trained up for anything in particular. Do you know what I mean? And that's a shame, because most of them have it in their mind from a young age, so I'm going to be a footballer. Then they get to 19, 20, rejected. You know, I would have been the same if it happened to me at that age. I'd have been absolutely gutted. But it's down to mentality in a lot of ways. Some kids have to have this strength of mentality to think, I'll show them. Yeah. I'll come back, you know.
Now, when you left the SFA, you didn't quite hang up your briefcase just yet.
No.
And you rocked up as the chief executive at Rangers.
No, I was director of football.
Oh, right, okay.
I was director of football, yeah.
Yes, big difference.
Yes.
Right. I think the next three questions you've got are now going to be cancelled.
Oh, no. Well, you were there when things started to go.
Yeah, I was director of football, so I had no say in the operations of the club whatsoever. I was only involved with players and trying to develop the football side of things. The people who had taken over, I had only one or two meetings with them, and I did speak to, there was a chief executive, he was called the chief operating officer rather than chief executive at that time, a guy called Ali Russell. He came in, and I used to talk to him, but with no understanding of where the whole thing was going. And basically, there was a lot of financial problems at the club that had been from existing period before that. The bank were looking for money. The there's a lot of people were owed money, and then the club got put into administration, and I just left. I was there 6 months, and I left it there.
Because it didn't just go wrong; it went badly wrong.
It went badly wrong because what happened was they thought they could come out of administration and do a deal, settle a deal with the Inland Revenue. And they didn't accept that, and the club went then into liquidation, which meant they also had to drop to Division 3 in Scotland, which meant it was a totally different thing. Well, it's now called Division 2. You've got Premier League, Championship 1 and 2. So they were in Division 2, which is the fourth tier of Scottish football, and Rangers had to start there. But I was already out of the club at that point.
Although, to be honest, I mean, in terms of Scottish football, that was, and the clubs in those lower days, having a club like the Rangers there and turning up, it was money in their coffers.
Absolutely.
That would have helped them.
Absolutely. The benefit was unbelievable for the clubs. The Rangers being at that level for a few seasons, a lot of the clubs, because they were getting Rangers twice as well, because they play each other twice, home and away. And a lot of the clubs, I mean, one club, I'll tell you, I wouldn't even name it who it was, and I spoke to one of the chairmen, and he said the Rangers' visit to them was equivalent to five seasons' money. Five seasons' gate money. Two games, right? Now, that's an indication of how much teams benefited from it. But Rangers are on the way back now. They're recovering, but they're still not in a healthy enough state, but they're certainly a lot better than they were.
Well, they've just signed Jamie Murphy.
Yeah.
How do you think he'll get on there?
I think he'll do well. I think he's a good player. I think that the Rangers have been short in certain positions, and they've brought in a few foreign players that just did not work out at all. Mexican, Portuguese.
At least Jamie. Managers as well.
Well, exactly. That was a mistake. Total mistake. And I said it quite openly about it at the time when he got appointed. But Jamie Murphy, I think, is a good player. Hasn't quite worked out for Brighton. I thought he was still could have offered something for Brighton, to
I
be honest with you.
Felt that,
Most people you speak to here were surprised to see Jamie go.
Is that right? Yeah.
And we certainly felt that.
Rangers fans certainly seem excited by him coming along.
Yes, they are. Because he did well at Motherwell. He looked a very good player when he played at Motherwell.
Jamie is something that we haven't got. He's someone who will get the ball and he'll run straight at the goal.
People, yes.
And he's direct.
He was always our best one-on-one with a keeper.
Yeah.
You know, the number of strikers we've had through will fluff a chance with a one-on-one, and Murphy was the one who seemed to. That said, I mean, he's a wide player, but I think at Motherwell he also was a centre forward for a wee bit as well. So
he did. He played through the middle, but I think Rangers are looking to fit him in, and in terms of what they've already got there, he's a big improvement. So I think it'd be a good signing for them. Yeah.
Sure.
Now, I mean, we'll just move on, last thing on Scottish football. I mean, where do you see, I mean, it's not a competitive league anymore.
Do you
see a time when Celtic and when once Rangers, of course, up, that they will come out and join a British Super League or a European
Super League? There's a possibility of it, yeah. I definitely think it could happen. But at the moment, the problem is you've not got the competition. You haven't any competition for years in Scotland, apart from when it's Rangers against Celtic. As long as those two clubs are in a healthy position, and they're big, but at the moment that's not happened. You've only got Celtic at the moment, are huge.
Want the other clubs to be challenging as well.
They won't ever, though. There's no chance, because Rangers and Celtic are too big, and in terms of the money they've got just from support and all that sort of thing, they're on a different level, so you're not going to get it. In England, you're getting down the stage now where you've maybe got about five or six teams in the same position, haven't you?
Yeah. And they're way ahead of everyone else.
Yes.
I mean, once upon a time when Liverpool, I mean, I'm just thinking back 25 years when we're talking Liverpool, Everton, Arsenal, even Ipswich, you know, well, say 35 years ago, and there was kind of, there'd be a team that would rise up now and again.
Yeah.
There was never a massive gap. I mean, all right, the eighth that the Albion achieved, or 13th we eventually got, but, with a little more, it wouldn't have taken too much more to have gone up another four or five places.
Well, that's now, why the Leicester thing was incredible, wasn't it? That was just amazing.
We started the story in 1980, and Aston Villa won the league and Ipswich came
second.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ipswich.
And Liverpool were a great team at the time. Yeah. And Man United were strong. You know what I mean? And Tottenham were a great team at the time.
Absolutely. But that they went down in that time. But yeah, I mean, Ipswich were, I think they were in the top four for every year from 74 to 83, with one exception, and that was 78, and they won the cup that year anyway.
Is that right? Yeah.
So we're getting near to the end of this, Gordon. I mean, we talked about many, many things. I mean, we do appreciate you coming in. It's lovely to see you. For anyone who can't see this on Super Reverb Vision, Gordon looks exactly the same as when he mucked up that chance in the opening round. So you've got no. Is there anything, cup final replay aside, cup final extra time aside, is there anything as a player, as an administrator, that you look back and you think, I wish I'd done that differently?
I think there's a few things that I felt would have happened. If I'd known about the clubs that were interested in me, I might have made more of that. I felt that I regret one thing about the cup final, that I didn't, after scoring the first goal, I didn't show off a little bit. I look back now and I think I should have gone and made a name for myself that day, just by being doing things what I could have done, being a more of an individual on the day. That's for sure. That is the God's honest truth. And then my miss in the final is something I'll never get over. I have to say it again. I'm a full, everybody listening just now, whether you hate me or you don't hate me, I do apologise to you, because I never have got over it and I never will.
I've got to cut across you here and go and say, but what that thing is, actually, I think encapsulates Brighton and Hove Albion in a nutshell. You know, always the very nearly, always the bridesmaid.
Yeah.
It's, you know, even like last season, we were about to go up, flying up as champions, and we stumble at the last hurdle.
Right.
I mean, it's just the sort of sodding typical story of Brighton. How about you? So in that sense, that miss would have been, sorry, if you'd have scored, it would have been very un-Brighton.
Maybe, but I laugh about it, because when people mention it, you know, I say, you know, what if you'd scored? I said, if I'd scored, I would actually probably be mayor of Brighton still.
Yes.
Still living in this town. Would I have to buy dinner anywhere now?
You'd be 20 stone.
You'd be Peter Ward.
Yeah, exactly.
Your hand would never go into your pocket.
No, but like that. As I say, but I've got to say, the people have been treated so well down here over the years, that's what I really appreciate. That I come down here, it's not, I don't ever get treated badly by anybody. Everybody's so nice. And I love my time here, and I'll never stop coming down here. I'm down just now, I'm meeting friends over the next couple of days and all that, and going to the game, and I will continue to do that, because, as I say, I don't feel as if I'm isolated when I come down here. I don't feel under any pressure about it, and I'm quite willing, even if somebody comes and says to me, like, you know, you should have scored that goal, I go, I know, I should have, and I apologise.